This meeting is now being recorded.
And thank you. And good night. Good afternoon. This is the final session of the third face-to-face of the CCT review team, and everyone has been working hard and keeping their complaints to a minimum, and so that's excellent. And so thank you for that. And so I appreciate everyone soldiering through. These very intense days are tough. It's like being at an ICANN meeting. You almost need a day of recovery after. So thank you for that. What I think we want to do is get some hear some updates from the two sub-teams that we just divided into, get any kind of feedback on some of the open questions. So as we've talked about in the past, if there's anything that felt unresolved that you'd like the larger group to provide input into, this is a good time to bring that up. We'll go some next steps in other business and our next meeting and things like that. But without further ado, let me pass it to Laureen.
Thanks, Jonathan. Alice is going to get up our latest and greatest incarnation of our project questions document. But before that, I want to give a huge thank you to my fabulous sub-team, who, even though we have had a grueling session, retained their sense of humor and good cheer and even volunteered for various tasks, which I greatly appreciate. So we have reconfigured a little bit and reorganized, scaled back a touch, really tried to divide our work into a couple of different buckets with questions that we want answered and sources of data for those questions, some of which falls into our purview of safeguards, other which falls into our purview of consumer trust. We realize among the group that these are very intertwined and related concepts, but in certain cases the data is lives in different places. So we thought that it at least to consider how we're going to divide and conquer the work, it would make sense to separate that. So one of our first buckets is DNS abuse. And we have this first because we think part of this is going to be a threshold issue when we delve into the more specific data about DNS abuse. So these are more narrative questions that there are going to be various sources of data for. And they're up on the screen, but I'll read this aloud. Is DNS abuse more or less prevalent in UGTLDs? Are there higher rates of abuse per registrar, registry, or resellers in new versus legacy GTLDs? We realize that data may not be available for all this, but there probably is some data available. DNS abuse policies, what does that look like for new GTLD registries and registrars? Enforcement mechanisms, again, a comparison. Looking at ICANN compliance data, because they have a lot of data in this regard. ICANN compliance also has a separate category of abuse complaints. So that's one bucket of activity, and you'll see we have volunteers for that bucket. Jordan, did you have questions about that particular item?
Yeah, I do. Are you guys making any attempt to look at the interaction with new GTLDs and level of DNS abuse overall? Because I could imagine, this is a hypothetical, I could have a TLD.honeypot, and this TLD could be free maybe, so it's super attractive to bad actors. But I also have super aggressive anti-abuse policies in place. So all the bad people move to my TLD, but then I like kill them really fast. So the overall level of abuse in the ecosystem might go down, even though my TLD might be 100% abuse. And so I'm wondering if you guys are making any attempt to look at the overall level of abuse as opposed to just like, oh, this TLD looks bad or that TLD looks bad.
I'm going to ask Drew to field that.
This is Drew for the record. Brian and I are working together to craft a methodology that an outside vendor could use to conduct a study. And so what we've discussed is that there's a need for two things. So there's the historical analysis from when the new GTLDs were first introduced, factoring in all of the sunrise periods and so on, which would not which would still be over time and could potentially capture what you're asking. But then there's the importance to do a second thing, which would be a going forward study from some point in time, let's say from today for the next 6 months, which then would we would see abuse levels over time, and we'd see price as a component, and also we want to apply, Jonathan has mentioned us potentially being able to apply pricing data going backwards too, and so if we have all of those factors, I don't see why we couldn't find an example like what you're describing, where we would at first see, oh, there's a lot of abuse in this TLD, but then we'd realize the pricing was very low, so we draw that correlation, oh, perhaps the price lured these bad guys, but then we saw that bad TLDs didn't resolve for more than one day at a time, I guess, is what you're thinking in your scenario, because they just get rid of
them
instantly.
Yeah, I guess my point is more that it seems like regardless of how prevalent abuse is within the new TLDs per se, what we really care about is whether overall the Internet is more or less safe after the introduction of new TLDs. And so it seems like what you really want to look at is what's the overall level of abuse and how's that trending and how's that been affected by the new TLDs. And I gave like a crazy made-up example of a way that you might say, oh, the new all the abuse in the world is now on new TLDs, but maybe there's only half as much abuse as there was before. So then, therefore, you would say, even though the new TLDs have all the abuse, that they would actually be like an amazing benefit for the Internet. And so I'm just trying to make sure that we're keeping our eye on, like, what's the overall trend being, Ben, as opposed to, like, just saying, like, oh, these TLDs have more or less than the legacy ones, because what we really care about is the overall trend, right?
I apologize. I misunderstood your question. So to answer that, then yes, absolutely. We're looking at all GTLDs with what we're proposing should be done with the study. So that way we could basically come to a conclusion on exactly what you're asking, as well as these more nuanced things that will allow us to see whether or not there's any relationship between some of the safeguards in the new GTLDs and levels of abuse and whatnot. But, yeah, we'd still be looking at the overall ecosystem so that we find out if bad guys just jumped from legacy GTLDs to new GTLDs or abuse went down overall or whatnot.
Thanks for that question, Jordan. That's a very good point. And thanks for your answer, Drew. The next bucket that we're looking at, oh, David, how could I not see you?
David Taylor, for the record. I'm going to forget my question.
I think it's where you're sitting.
It might be. I'll sit somewhere else next time, maybe the back of the room. just picking up on Jordan's point there, I'm wondering, because I think that is a very good question, but do we have a measurement of the total abuse in the ecosystem prior to 2012? Because what do we compare, and how do we do that? That's all. But I think it's a very good question. I'm just wondering how on earth we go about and see whether the total abuse has gone down or up.
So I'm looking at Brian to ask that question, not that you need to answer it now, but maybe there's a source we could look to. I don't know, but you're right. We would want a baseline if we're going to do any sort of comparison. So maybe that's something we can add to our task list to see what data sources there are.
This is Brian for the record. In the DNS abuse report, we referenced Symantec's yearly security reports. And as far as I know, they've produced one of those every year going back. I'm not sure how long, but I know that kind of overall information is definitely out there from various different sources. So we'll also want to look into sort of the methodology behind it and see if that's actually the best source of data. But the short answer to your question is yes, it's out there from my sense of things.
Good. So our next bucket of activities, and this is one of our more intricate buckets, is the impact of the safeguards and public interest commitments. And here, all of our subgroup is involved, although we've parsed it out into separate sections. So if you can scroll down on this document, Alice, we have a list of questions here. Can we scroll? Who's holding the – Brenda. Brenda, can you scroll down? Yeah, so if we can just have impact of safeguards and public interest commitments, so and just so the screen shows all the questions. Okay, so these are sort of big matrix questions. Has the safeguard been triggered, exercised? What was the impact? What was the intent of the safeguard? Was the intent achieved? And for this result, we think it's important to ask why or why not, because certainly a lot of the data goes to this. In fact, our huge reading list of 60 or so documents, many hundreds of pages, in some cases goes into a lot of detail about specific types of abuse. So we have we've divided the safeguards and public interest commitments into these categories: DNS abuse and more technical safeguards, Spec 11 and GAC advice, rights protection mechanisms, and for names collision and I don't know why that says RPMs, because RPM that should be edited out. It's not RPMs, but names collision, we decided that isn't within that isn't something we're going to focus on. Does anyone have any questions about that? Okay, for our next can you scroll down to the next item then? Our next item really focuses on consumer and end user behavior. And this goes to some of the data that's available in the Nielsen survey from consumers, consumer awareness of the new GTLDs, consumer trust. And we really want to try and apply the Nielsen findings to certain safeguards, because certain of the Nielsen findings, for example, do relate to, for example, an expectation that TLDs should have certain restrictions, consumers having expectations when they are dealing with domains in regulated industries. That's just by way of an example. So these are lists of questions that we want to tackle: how the new DTLG string itself may impact user expectations, delve into these questions by looking to the Nielsen survey, among other things. Can you scroll down so we see the rest of the questions? And then we also have another more general question about consumers knowing where to go to report problems. We have as a placeholder to think about whether we need to add anything about trademark and right protection issues here. That's kind of a David Taylor question to think about.
Kissing cabinet.
Right. Can we scroll down? Mm-hmm. Most of our questions for developing countries are really being tackled as part of the application process subteam, so you'll see that's crossed out in this document. And then finally, as our last category, we have effectiveness of procedures to enforce safeguards. So this really deals with ICANN's role and how the safeguards and public interest commitments are being enforced and how certain dispute resolution processes are working to enforce safeguards, particularly rights protection mechanism safeguards. And Jonathan, I see you have a question.
Just a point of clarification, and maybe I just, you went by it quickly. What did you say about name collisions?
That we didn't really see that as within our consumer trust remit, or it is as a priority. Yeah, unless we're misunderstanding it.
I guess that's interesting. I only say that to say, we got a presentation on it, right?
I think that's because we didn't understand it, though.
Oh, okay. I mean, I guess the question is that there was a concern raised by ESSAC and then the community, and then there were measures put in place, and I think the rationale for it, to some extent, maybe what you're saying is you think of it as a security and stability
issue.
Exactly
it. Yeah,
and
but
so,
exactly
but I guess the question then is whether or not those collisions that could have resulted in things going out into the open air that should have been internal would have had an impact on trust then. I mean, I always assumed that it was a part of it, and certainly I know Jeff Newman is assuming that it's something that we're addressing, and so I just wanted to think that through a tiny bit. Yeah, go ahead, Carlos.
Yes, we have to think about it, and we did not have in our reading list as of yesterday the relevant ESSAC papers, which are 45, 62, and 66, so we added them to our list. There are invalid queries, name collision, risk, and collisions, and we have to go through them, but we realized that only yesterday. So we will review this, but this is the working assumption.
So it's not a definitive decision to drop it, but you're thinking you might after you read those things. Is that what you mean?
We think they come from that remit, and we are going to read papers producing that remit, the SAC papers, so to sustain the hypothesis. And if we're wrong, we might revise it, yes. But we have to go a little bit deeper. It doesn't make sense to. It's just a note. We had a discussion on that. We have the gut feeling of the majority that is that way. We have to look through these three papers, which is a response from ESSAC to the PDP, an official note they wrote to Avery yesterday. You might have seen it, and we will come back.
So, Carlos, can I ask you to look at the papers and report to us, or is someone else going to? I'm seeing finger pointing. Oh, you both are?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So maybe both of you then can do that.
Okay. Can I say, we're looking at the paper, but as I argued in the breakout session, yes, I understand that name collisions might contribute to insecurity and instability. But with respect to the focus, and we have to prioritize, and with respect to the focus on consumer
trust
and safeguards.
Right.
It was tenuous. That was the position. But we're still going to look at it. We're committed to looking at the papers and respond to them.
So that's the feel of the group at this point before we've heard a report on the papers. So if after we hear a report on the papers, first of all, we'll hear a report on the papers and we'll discuss it. And if folks want to lobby us to reconsider, please, you know, do so. But you're going to need to convince us that this is a priority area within consumer trust. It struck us as more tenuous.
Yeah, and it could very well be that has a home in application evaluation or something too. There's a lot of ways to look at it. I guess it has the benefit of having done some things that could probably be thought of as having made the process go better, right? Some of the things that got excluded as a result of those procedures safeguards that were put in place prevented something that would have been a ding on the program. right? And so, I mean, I guess that's just a question. We're reviewing the new GTLD program. There was a potential downside. There was something fixed. It was something about the system working the way it ought to, right? And is there some value to that in making that a part of the review? That's what I heard in the presentation that we got, was that there was some, you know, benefits that were accrued from it that, you know, made this process better than it would have been otherwise. I guess that's, and maybe finding a precise home for it is part of the challenge, but that's what I remember hearing on the, mm-hmm. in the presentation, and that feels like a feel good thing to include, I guess, but let me, I'll yield the microphone to Jordan.
So, this is Jordan Buchanan. I didn't hear the presentation. I guess it's not obvious to me that the name collision procedure prevented anything particularly bad, in that ICANN's had a reporting mechanism, and certainly nothing that met the threshold of endangerment to human life has been reported. And there's been a small number of issues that I'm aware of that have been reported through ICANN or to registry operators as a result of name collision, but most have struck me as relatively minor. I think there's a separate issue of the non-delegation of CORP Home and Mail, which was not the name collision procedure per se. It was just like, you guys aren't allowed to proceed.
I guess I saw that as part of the
But even those, I think the benefit would be more speculative than realized. No one's actually been attempted to measure what the direct benefit would be. There's a speculation that it would have some harm, but no one's been able to study what the harm would actually be per se.
Anyway,
which is not to say whether or not we should include it in our report. I agree with Jonathan that it feels like something is potentially in scope, and if we don't take a look at it, someone else will have. Like I feel like necessarily then the subsequent procedures PDP will have to take a look at it, because we would have to decide whether we thought it was a worthwhile feature of the program for the next time that we allocate any subsequent attempt to allocate new GTLDs, because that was a procedure that was not anticipated by the GNSO policy and was just sort of implemented on the fly by ICANN. And so at some point, I think that's a really good example of the sort of thing that needs to be evaluated before,
moving on.
It's the sort of thing that ought to be evaluated before moving on, although maybe you could also just accept that it seemed to work well enough and we could just do another allocation of TLDs and just keep doing what we were doing because nothing particularly bad happened last time.
Well, I think we'll be better positioned to think about this after we hear these RSAC papers, because candidly, I still think we're struggling to understand exactly the impact of these name collisions and how it relates to consumer trust, and perhaps these papers will help educate us on that. SAC, SAC.
So, very very quickly, I'm sorry. I guess part of it is going back to the text of the review, our remit in the first place, and really asking the questions whether Safeguards has a capital S or a lowercase s, right? There's this notion of looking at the safeguards that were put in place, lowercase. I'm agreeing with you, Carlos. So the things that were put in place to mitigate the consequences to the program. Right, so I mean, I know that safeguards with a capital S means something very specific and is a term of art, but the actual language of our remit says basically the mitigation procedures we put in place, were they effective? And that's kind of why I felt like it was in. So when you talk about safeguards with a large S, I can see why it doesn't fit, but with a small S, it feels like it does. Right. We'll wait to hear back from the reading of the document.
But that's where we are for now. We have pen holders for all these categories. We have some deadlines for our for our first bucket of domain abuse, which actually is our largest bucket. So we are happy to have managed to come up with a list of questions and a list of projects to go forward. We do anticipate this is going to be a living document to a certain extent, so we may tweak it, but at least now we have more of a map of where we're going.
Thanks. So we've spent the last couple of days in two areas on the competition and consumer choice subteam. The first is taking an effort started by Stan and generalizing it out. You can actually see some evidence of it on the wall here. But what we've been trying to do is go from a general notion of having data to looking at the specific questions that we had previously identified at the Marrakesh meeting that were priorities for us to answer. So, for example, a question might be, have the new GTLDs produced price competition amongst GTLDs? Have they produced non-price competition? Have the benefits of consumer choice outweighed the costs of the introduction of new GTLDs? So those are the sorts of questions we've tasked ourselves with trying to answer, and we have taken some time to take a look at data sources and review them, and now we're going the next step and saying, how do we look at this data in a way that will allow us to help answer these questions? And so we've been trying to identify data analysis projects. And so one example of a project might be, and this is one of the ones that Stan identified, we have a bunch of market share data. We know how many registrations occur in various TLDs. And let's go and take that data and do some economist-style analysis and calculate market concentration in various ways. So we plug those numbers into formulas and say, using standard measures of market concentration, here's what we're seeing in the GTLD space, for example. Or what fraction of the market is occupied now by the new GTLDs? What fraction of new registrations is occupied but has been in new GTLDs as opposed to legacy GTLDs? So spent quite a bit of time trying to identify what the specific projects were. We've made some good progress in that we started yesterday with, I think, four of the six major questions that we hope to answer without having any projects associated with them. And now each of them has at least one, and most of them have more than one projects associated with them. So now we think that we have identified the sort of data we want and the analysis that we're hoping to do for most of our questions. And we're hoping by the end of this week, actually, as a little bit of homework for folks, that we'll have really well-specified projects that we think are actionable by either the analysis group or staff or ourselves or someone could take the specification for one of these projects and go do the work. And then the results of those projects should roughly, the way I think about it is the results of those projects will constitute sort of the data tables that we're going to put in our report. And then once we have that, then we can start to write some words around what we've discovered as a result of this analysis. So, I won't bore you with the tedium of going through all of the projects, but we're happy to share the list. Eliza's pulled something together. But I'm actually going to ask for Eliza's help because several of the projects we identified, we thought you guys might already on the safeguards and consumer trust team might already be doing some related work, and so we don't want to have both sub-teams doing the same work. So it would make sense to see to what extent we should be coordinating on those projects. So, Eliza, can you tell me the projects that we identified as potentially having overlap?
I'm
working on it right now. I'm trying to put it all on a table in a logical way. Let's see. I think the first one I just came across had to do with UDRP and URS policies. That was suggested as a topic that might be might fall under the category of non-price competition between different registries. The group also suggested that this might be covered by the TMCH review.
I think here Dan had proposed that we look to see whether, and I think this is largely a comparison against legacy TLDs and CCTLDs, as to whether the URS and UDRP, the existence of those from a consumer choice perspective, made the new GTLDs more attractive. And so we were wondering to what extent you guys on the Safeguards and Trust team were looking at the URS and UDRP. And then there's separately, we know that there's the TMCH review and there's also the RPM review happening. And so it's possible we should just defer all of this into one of those other places and not be in this review at all. But in any case, David now has his placard up.
Thanks. David Taylor. When you say whether the fact of the UDRP in the URS would make the new GTLDs more attractive to who? Registrants, cyber squatters, consumers who want to register and feel more protected. And I'm just trying to also...
Yeah, so I think it would be some combination of... So using our definition of consumer, it would be either would a registrant prefer to register in one of these, knowing that somehow the space was more pure and free of terrible cyber squatting, or maybe a end user would be more likely to navigate to one of these because they felt that they were less likely to encounter bad results.
So, David, and yeah, which comes down to the safeguards and trust, whether we trust the TLD. So it's certainly in our remit on that sense, whether the fact of having... I mean, the UDRP exists, so it's just the addition of the URS, and I suppose you'd argue to say the Trademark Clearinghouse, whether those alone make the general public feel safer. Probably not, because they only know about the URS on the time that they find out that they've been squatted, which would be too late to feel safe. So I don't interesting, I don't know. It's kind of, I'm not sure, and how does that affect on competition for it to be in your kind of group?
I think only to the extent if people trusted a TLD more, they might be more likely to – so we don't know, I guess. That would be a follow-on question of are trusted TLDs more likely to be competitively effective or not, I guess would be the question. Is that – am I capturing your intent right, Dan?
Yeah, just generally that's what you answered. We are looking at it from the angle of non-price competition. So – are there new GTLD and GTLD in general more competitive if you compare with CCTLDs? Some CCTLDs don't have UDRP or ADR at all. So would be some value for potential registrants or someone who starts the UDRP process and have started the process to see who has the right to register potential domain name. So we're looking, it for from different angle than the other sub-team.
Sorry, Stan, was that a question?
So David, I'm taking from you, are you guys, it sounds like you're not currently looking at the effect of the trademark protections on consumer trust as part of your remit? Is that a correct statement?
This is Drew for the record. We are, but only within a certain restricted paradigm. So it's, you know, we have the list of the safeguards. We see what the intent of the safeguard was, whether or not the safeguard was ever even triggered to begin with. So that alone, we saw no instances during which the safeguard was relied upon. And then with some of the examples you're giving, we're not going to know if just the existence of the safeguard alone created a sense of trust, even though it was never triggered, and that sense of trust led to a user actually investing in a new TLD and registering a domain name, especially such as a brand or something. And then after we see if it's been triggered, if it has been triggered, we're going to look at the result of, what happened, and did the safeguard fulfill its intent? Did it not fulfill its intent? Why didn't it? And from there, that part is our best area from which we could gather information about consumer trust, where we could see if trust had been broken, perhaps. But for us, we're separately from this, we're exploring trust as its as a whole category in and of itself with the other areas that Laureen went over. And so in that, we could potentially reach conclusions that perhaps all the safeguards are fantastic. However, there weren't enough safeguards because there are still all these other consumer trust issues in the new GTLDs that have been broken down. So those are the different ways in which we're looking at it. So going back to your initial question or your initial example about UDRP and URS, if you looked at that specific example, I guess the question to you would be, is what we're doing going to be fulfilling enough for you guys? Because I don't know that what we're doing would answer that competition question about whether people are migrating to the new GTLDs based on this safeguard.
So I guess a couple of questions for staff, I think. The first is, so there is the TMCH review happening right now. Could someone from staff maybe speak to the scope of that review and whether it would, to what extent it might cover any of these related discussions?
Thanks.
And then I have the same question for the RPM review. I haven't been following that work, but maybe someone who's in the, is that you, David, or your liaison? Who's our liaison to the RPM? Sure. I guess I'm just, if someone knows enough, if someone in this room currently knows enough about the RPM PDP, that might be interesting to know as well whether they're anticipating covering this ground.
So this is Karen Luntz. On the Trademark Clearinghouse independent review, there's some look at disputes. So what do rights holders choose to put in the clearinghouse versus what do they choose to protect? Say by following by registering a Sunrise or by filing a URS case or filing a UDRP. So there's some correlations being examined there. As far as the use of URS is a little out of scope for that. That review is focused on the clearinghouse, and the sort of competitive effects of having that in a TLD versus not having it is not really in scope for that. In terms of the RPM PDP, I can look at the charter right now. I don't. It's pretty broad in terms of the number of topics and questions that they've posed to cover. I think that group is kind of at the beginning of its process, so there's probably still room to raise more questions if we think that should be covered there.
Okay, thanks, Karen. So maybe what I'll suggest is, Aliza, can we assign to Dan actually specifying that project? What research would we want to do what analysis would we want to do if we were to try to answer your question? And then I think maybe we could propose to the liaison, figure out who the liaison to the RPM.
Me, apparently.
Oh. David could
was
take.
Just told.
David could take back to that that PDP group whether they'd be interested in answering that question. If they don't want to, then we'll have to answer it ourselves if we think it's in scope.
David Taylor, I just put one caveat. I did sign up for that, the PDP on that, but I haven't opened a single email yet because there's just too many emails and I can't keep up with them all. So I don't actually know whether I'm the best liaison person. I will try to, and I'll certainly attend at Helsinki. But,
Okay, thanks for that. But let's start with Dan specifying what the exact work would be that we would want to accomplish. All right, that's number one of the things that we thought there might be overlap. Aliza, what's the next one on our list?
All right, lost my place. Oh, here it is. It was under question 5, which had to do with whether the benefits of the increase in choice outweighed the potential for the cost of confusion, and the project we had noted was the frequency of brand and trademark registration across new GTLDs. So this is kind of a related topic.
Oh, I turned it off. I meant to turn it on. The question I think we had was to what extent we saw trademarks being registered in the new GTLDs. And we wondered if you guys were looking at that as part of your look at safeguards and trust. Drew is shaking his head now, so. Which marks are actually being registered, whether by the trademark owner or not, and then potentially as a follow-up, whether by the trademark owner or not.
So this is Karen, and that's also something that's being looked at in the Trademark Clearinghouse review. Looking at marks and claims and amounts of registrations in a selection at least of TLDs.
Okay, so maybe we could look to try to channel that work into the TMCH review, or make sure that the TMCH review is already doing it. All right, Aliza?
The next one, how much fraud is there in new GTLDs?
Yes, so is the safeguard and trust team looking to try to quantify the amount of fraud or maybe abuse in general exists? Sounds like yes, based on our previous conversation. All right, so we're going to defer that work to you.
Real quick, could you define fraud beyond abuse? In the sense, abuse is the big umbrella category for us, which would include all kinds of things that could be considered fraud. But for you guys, could you define
I don't think we made any attempt to.
Oh, okay.
We're not deep thinkers on this topic like you guys.
Then our answer is yes. We have that.
So similar, another one is the TMCH reducing the cost of possible UDRP URS cases?
Yes. So I think that might be.
Is presence of a string in the trademark clearinghouse a good indicator of fewer trips to resolution procedures like URS? I think is what that was. An indicator correlated to fewer trips to resolution procedures.
Is it actually helpful to be in the TMCH?
Well, David here, but I think there's two bows to that. I think there's the one whether being in it, you might file more UDRPs. I'd say potentially, URSs you would because you get the notifications. So that in effect means you're aware earlier on of a bad actor doing something, so you may or may not file a URS or a UDRP based on that.
So, I mean, this is John again, I'm sorry. I guess the question is it just more information for trademark holders, or is it a behavior modifier for potential trademark violators? I guess that's the distinction I was trying to get to, which is there any indication that there's fewer transgressions as a result of them getting that warning?
David here, I think it's fewer than what? And again, it's very hard to compare, isn't it? Because what do you compare to? You know, a legacy TLD or which legacy TLDs? It's an open new GTLD against an open legacy TLD, bearing in mind the number of applications and length of time of existence. It's quite a thing to do. I mean, I'm guessing it's Trademark Clearinghouse review to an extent.
Yeah, I agree with David's last conclusion, this does feel like a topic that would ideally get handled by the TMC. I mean, hopefully the TMC's review is going to help tell us whether it was useful or not. But one, when as a baseline matter, David, one, I don't know if Google is unique or if there's other registry operators doing some form of a longer claims process, but in our TLDs at least, we have permanent claims process. So in that model, you might ask, oh, does this, like when you look at the number of bad actions happening, is it less frequent in TLDs that have longer claims, like during claims periods, than it is outside of claims periods? That might tell you whether the claims period, at least, was useful at deterring abuse.
Sorry, and David Taylor then, following up on that. I think that's a very interesting point, and I think it raises another one, because I thought about it in our safeguards. When we're looking at the URS, the UDRP, and which rights protection mechanisms, at that point, I didn't mention it then, I was thinking, well, do we go into the specific mechanisms which new GTLD registries are putting in place, which are different, such as donuts, and then look at those? And that point, so it's great you actually said that, made me think, oh, is this a competition aspect? So this is me punting one back from our side to you and saying, is that something which is your, because there's a competition aspect there between the registries and what Google are offering. Absolutely, I think there you've gone a step further, which is what a lot of the rights protection community wanted. You've done that, so there's competition aspects, and I think that's just an interesting one, really.
Yeah, and this gets back to, I think, Dan's analysis of, like, is it helpful to have better rights protection in terms of a competition, from a competition angle? But I do think I don't know, Karen, is any sort of analysis along those lines of whether, like, the claims period works envisioned in the TMCH review, or is it just looking at the actual mechanics of putting stuff in the TMCH?
Well, this is Karen. It is examining the claims period data as much as we have. So it'll tell you, like, you know, for each clearinghouse record, like how many notices were downloaded for that, and then looking across TLDs, like how many claims transactions did they report, how many, you know, times were claims notices displayed. You know, there's some challenges with sort of extrapolating from that what the numbers tell you about, you know, registrant understanding and acceptance of those notices. But the point about registries having different lengths of claims periods, I don't know that anybody is looking at. Although I think it would show up in the reports as they continue to occur. So let me make a note of that.
Sure. Yeah. I guess sort of independent of the duration of the claims period, you could just sort of look at, like, the fraction of the registrations that occurred during claims periods, what fraction of those ended up being going to URS or UDRP versus those that occurred outside of claims periods, and whether there's a difference. Yeah. All right.
Sorry, David, just follow up on that. And to remember there that when we look at how many go to UDRP or URS is one thing, but bear in mind that a lot of them will be cease and desists, so you never get. I mean, sort of as an estimate, I'd say maybe 5 to 10% of the cases we're involved in ever go to a URS or a UDRP, so it's cease and desist. So that kind of fudges everything.
Do you have any other ideas about how IAKM might quantify the amount of trademark abuse happening?
It's the only public way of doing so, yeah.
So two things. One is that I think it might be valuable, again, to take a step back from this and get back to sort of Larry's notion of immortalized here is, did the benefits of choice sort of exceed the costs? That's where we're looking at defensive registrations and things like that. So I think that's part of what people are kind of looking for is, so sort of, is this a net benefit in a way? And that's why we're trying to get at some of these answers. And so just pushing things off to TMCH might make it difficult for us to make that assessment. So finding a finite way to go into them might be of some value. But the other thing that I guess I would remind people about is that we are trying to do a survey of trademark owners, potentially through INTA, and so what we may be partly doing here is expanding the questions that are part of that survey.
Yeah, sorry, Jonathan, it's Jordan one more time. And I guess I would say, depending on the timing of the TMCH review, it's conceivable that could get done before us and we could just we could outsource a little bit of our work.
That'd be great.
Essentially. Karen, is that expected to be completed prior to our report's preliminary release?
This is Karen. Yes, it should be. Q3 is when we're targeting for the draft report, so the data should be available to you in there.
All right. So maybe in Elisa's document, we can flag that we think this analysis is going to be done by the TMCH review, and we'll make sure to take a look at those results as we're
in help.
Yeah, and obviously, yeah, it seems like if we'd be happy to talk with the folks working on the TMCH review about these matters to make sure they get incorporated. All right, Elisa, are there any? That's it. So those are the areas that we thought there might be some overlap, and it seems like it's mostly overlap with the TMCH review, although you guys are also doing the abuse quantification, so that will be helpful. David.
And I think it's David Taylor for the record. Yes, Jonathan just mentioned there with the potential INTA review, which we've been discussing there. I think there's an overlap there, and there may be something if we find that the Trademark Clearinghouse review isn't covering something, we can bring it into that review to ensure it is covered. And I suppose the only point there is just something which I know was raised of cost sharing for that review. I presume there's no issue with ICANN cost sharing with INTA on the review if sort of 50-50 split or something. I'm just throwing out that number. But I'm just—is it something which we need to discuss at some point? Because I know there was a question raised on that, so I don't want us to talk about it for another month, and we don't kickstart that review because we want to try and get them to do it.
Right, and that's a good question. And this budget thing, I guess, is something that's worthy of 30 seconds of overall. I think we are at the point, with the exception of probably this project with AIM Global, of ceasing to worry about the FY16 budget, right, and whatever we left on the table and things like that, because I think we'd drive ourselves a little bit nuts. So there are numbers that are allocated for FY17. So the first thing might be at some point, not to put you on the spot now, is to understand what that is, and look at the studies that we're talking about trying to do in the DNS abuse and the applicant survey are big ones. And then potentially this trademark owner survey, I think, are the three big things we're talking about, and seeing if that's going to be disruptive to your predicted budget, and we need to escalate to Teresa or Xavier or whatever that process might end up being. So maybe if we can make that a to-do to figure out what those budget numbers are, and so that we can kind of assess where we are, because it could be that we're covered. To answer David's question, I threw out rather carelessly on a call with INTA that included people from INTA. It was the IPC call being held at INTA. The possibility that if money was one of the things slowing them down in helping do this survey of their members, that we might be able to help with that. And so there's two sides to that. One is, do we have enough money? But the other is there any kind of procedural issue with trying to pitch in, as David said, to spur that along, because we'd rather it happen sooner rather than later. And it is something that we would, absent the presence of INTA, try to do ourselves. And that's just that might be a better way to do it. So that question's aimed at staff. Is there anything improprietous about splitting that cost with them? So it's probably Mardi and
Yeah, sorry,
Karen.
I'm not following the question.
Conducting a survey of INTA members will cost money. They're trying to find money, and so I threw out there, hey, we'll pitch in some of the money for that too. So was I wrong to do that? Is the question I'm asking? Is it somehow bad to, because it's a single organization that we're putting money? Trying to think outside the box or optics or anything else. Separately, we'll figure out about how much money it is, but is doing that okay? I mean, is that...
I'll think about it. This is Margie. How is it different than retaining a vendor to do a study?
We probably would. That's the whole point. Yeah. We would retain a vendor and make their membership the population we surveyed, probably.
But we'll take it back, and yeah, we'll get you an answer on that. I just, off the top of my head, I don't see a problem with it.
I didn't either, but I wanted to make sure I didn't misspeak.
Yeah, so David Taylor for the record. Just following up on that, I think, in a way, if we want ownership of it, in my view, we should be paying for it. And I think maybe there's a little bit of a, and I've seen, obviously, we've been on the discussion with INTA and the people then saying, okay, well, we could do it, but who's paying for it? So we sort of end up in a discussion, which you see another month goes by. And actually, the way we should be doing it is saying exactly that, where we need a vendor to do it. We'll find the vendor. Can we go to the INTA membership? Yes or no. If not, we'll go to the ECTA membership. If not, we'll go to SONSA membership. But I think there's never going to be an issue with us going to their membership with an outside vendor doing it. And then it's really a question of whether INTA could use the results again. And I think they would say, yeah, whatever. So I just think really I'd kind of go around to, if we can pay for it, let's go ahead and do it and then take it from there.
So can I have just, who should I talk to about? So is it mostly David that's spearheading this? Okay, yeah, we'll work it out. We'll figure it out.
And then as a takeaway, help us figure out what our budget is for FY17 because of the other projects that we're identifying.
All right. So to wrap up the competition and consumer choice report, in addition to this project definition, we spent some time on market segmentation definitions. And once again, we've been looking at trying to come up with definitions of market segments by looking at topic areas, by sort of geographic groupings, and by language groupings. The good news is, I think, we did that. We now have pretty good lists for, I think, all the geographic TLDs for topic-based, a good set for topic-based TLDs. And the language group has done all but two of the languages that they could identify, and they just need to figure out what the heck the other two languages are. One challenge of working on the language group is sometimes it can be a little impenetrable, I guess. The bad news is I think we had quite a bit of discussion about how we were going to make the segmentation useful, and I don't think we've finally resolved that. I think we've decided that we want to keep trying to work at this and doing some analysis based on the segmentation work, but Kylie had some concerns, I think, as we started to look at the geographic separation, the geographic segmentation, we realized we would have some problems because, for example, if we said that if you lived in Shenzhen in China, you might think it would be totally reasonable to register in .Shenzhen, which exists, or the Shenzhen's in the province of Guangdong, so you might say, oh, I'll register in .Guangdong instead. Or maybe you would say, oh, no, I really want to appeal to all of China, so I'll register in .cn or the IDN equivalent for .cn. Or maybe you would want to register in .asia. And then, obviously, there's things like .com as well that are potential. But just looking from geography, there's four layers of potential registration. But it becomes very hard to compare because we don't want to compare the total registrations in .asia versus just the people in Shenzhen registering in .Shenzhen. And so how would we somehow make reasonable comparison? So Stan led us in some discussion about market definitions, but I think we still don't 100% understand how to split things up, and we may be looking at tactics like trying to look at registrants from a specific country or something like that to try to narrow this down. But there's some work left to do on figuring out how to approach the market segments now that we've identified them. But at the end of this, we roughly have a set of projects and a set of market definitions as pretty tangible outcomes of these 2 days. So I would say it's been successful. Those were the goals coming in. So we met our goals, and hopefully this gives us the ability to actually execute on work over the next couple of months, and then hopefully start drafting some text as we start to see numbers roll in. So I think that's our summary. Does anyone have questions?
This is Drew for the record. So in the end, were you able to, even for the geographic definitions, work out something that will be helpful in measuring those markets?
So I don't think we yet have the tactic. Like, I think what we know in an ideal world, what we would do in an ideal world, I think, is say for each of those four or five TLDs I just mentioned, Shenzhen, Guangdong, CN, Chinese version of CN, and .Asia, that we would go in and just extract just the registrants from Shenzhen and say what's the sort of market share and so on across each of those TLDs in Shenzhen. I don't think we can do that. I don't think we know how to do that. And so we're going to have to come up with some proxies that we can use. Maybe we can't do it at the city level and we need to jump up to a country level or something like that where we feel like we have better segmentation capabilities. Or maybe, you know, we do like a sample of who is data or something. We do a sampling of registrations or there may be some tactics. So we don't know exactly how we're going to execute on all the segmentation. In some cases, it may be the analysis group originally did a topic-based subdivision in their phase one report. And that seems a lot more straightforward and stands as the only member of one of our sub-sub teams has made some refinements to what the set of topics look like. So we should be able to do that analysis there. And even with languages, we may sort of say these feel like reasonable groupings already. It's just when we get to the geographic ones, because they're sort of concentric circles, that it becomes a little bit more complicated to figure out how to approach it.
This is Drew again. If you think of anything that maybe we could latch on to the DNS abuse study, there, even though it would be unrelated to abuse and be market-related, let me know, because that study will be looking at all these zone files, all this Whois data, I mean, all kinds of stuff. And so to the extent that you could also draw inferences from the same exact vendor, that might be vehicle to get something.
That might be helpful, yeah, so we should keep that in mind. So let's stay in touch.
Sorry, this is Jonathan. Any other questions for Jordan or Laureen? I just wanted to get that on the record for fun later when Laureen's reading the... All right. So thank you. Thanks for the update. Thanks to everyone for your work. And we've got a lot of work ahead of us. I know it's been a slog, but I think we're making some good progress. The next thing is some... next steps in terms of like our next meeting. We have some resolution there. And what else did you tell me that I was going to talk about at this point? My brain. Hello, which? And was it a different template than the one we talked about at the beginning? Or?
Right. So this template is, as part of the next steps, every sub team will need to drill down on substance and content. So we make sure there's some consistency across the sub-teams. So the idea here, Brenda, could you pull the template up? Just give Brenda a couple of seconds.
It's a favorite template we went over. We were talking about dividing things up by questions and things like that at the beginning, and I swear I'm just drawing a blank about what the distinction was for the... I feel like we talked about it. Do you remember which document it is, Alice? Or Lisa?
One moment, Brenda is pulling it up. There we go. Okay. So now you can see it on the screen. Can you just get rid of that? Thank you so much. Okay, so here's a suggested template to document every sub-team topic and focus, area of focus. So what we're suggesting here is to have a problem statement, the hypothesis, and then background material, findings, community input, potential recommendations, and anything to do with implementation of these recommendations. So as part of the next step, the idea would be to populate that and sort of circulate that as a discussion paper within the sub-teams.
Okay. I guess this is sort of like our other spreadsheet, but arranged vertically instead of horizontally at some level,
right?
It
drills down,
a little bit more in terms of the. I welcome feedback on this. This was a draft from staff. I mean, part of what would be. Sorry.
Just, I'm feeling here for the
purpose.
Not the purpose, the next steps. We had agreed in the safeguard sub-team that we have a table that Drew's going to help us with, going to help us with, and we were going to work together in small sub-teams to fill that out, to work that out. So are we saying we could do this before that or what?
I think this is more after. This is beginning to draft the report. This is sort of a structure that the report might take across all these questions that got asked of these groups. So you start with the question and then the sub-questions and then do these things for it and talk about the conclusions. And part of that has to do with the rigor that we were trying to engage in. When you look at the background material and data, is that you want to put in there the conclusions that we reached and kind of how we reached them. From as evidence-based a perspective as possible. Because in theory, when we make recommendations and then later on this review takes place again, they ought to be able to go to the same sources or types of evidence and detect whether or not the way we define the problem, things improved as a result of the recommendations, right? So the rigor of sort of documenting the problem statement but also the conclusions, you know, that this, in simplest terms, Stan has a calculation that's going to say that the percentage of new GTLD sales, the percentage of new TLD sales that's made up of by new GTLDs is X percentage. And we would love for that to be double 3 years from now, right? And recommend X, Y, and Z. So that's a statistic that they will then be able to recalculate at the next time of the next review to see if in fact the recommendations have the desired outcome. So that's the most kind of quantitative way we can do this, is to try and identify for the next research team or even staff reviews along the way, are the recommendations that are put in place showing an improvement based on the calculations we used to define the problem in the first place. Does that make sense? So that makes some modifications to this, that I can take a spin at. But I think this is largely right for that, but we may try to get a little bit more explicit about what we meant by background material data. It's like conclusions and basis for those conclusions, something like that, so that those whatever that basis is can be done again. Repeatable. The idea is to make the analysis repeatable.
This is Carlton for the record again. I understand what the objective of this is. It's the process now that is a bit of a challenge, because one of the things you want, if this is going to be, you want to have it written in one voice.
That's why there's a template.
Yes, but who is going to construct it in the template is going to be important.
So, Carlton, for instance, in the Safeguards and Trust today, you formed some teams of pen holders.
Right, so we have some sub-teams, and we're going to put our sub-teams together, me and Laureen, and going together, and we're going to do that. But then this is only going to be a small part of this final document. This is one document. This is not going to be multiple documents from each team.
And I'm talking about the high-level teams here, the competition and then the safeguards team. Just one person.
Okay, so let me just take your question right away. And my best answer at the moment is that the degree to which we define a vocabulary for the report, which is what this template does, that will help to create a similar voice across reports. In other words, if we talk about things as hypotheses, if we talk about things as findings, et cetera, that will help guide things into a similar voice. There will be an exercise after that, a review exercise for sure, and I'm guessing I'll be part of that exercise of literally trying to make it the same voice. But I think the degree to which we are successful in defining a vocabulary for the report, which is what the template attempts to do, it will help to guide us toward a similar voice.
No.
So, I mean...
I was just concerned about process.
Yeah. It's just that the sub-teams and the group in general is going a little nuclear in the sense that everybody's forming sub-teams seem to be consistent throughout what you're producing.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there'll be huge discrepancy between the sub-teams, and you need to have shells and information to frame the way, how you're going to work and how you're going to have an outcome that makes sense and that you can actually...
I'll take it as a to-do to dive into this with explanatory text, and that might help to make it an easier template to use, like an instruction manual for the template or something.
Can I work with you on that, Jonathan?
Please.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So the next thing is the next meeting.
Yes. So based on the doodle poll, it seems like August 29th and August 30th are the September meeting dates.
That's so classic ICANN.
What do you have in mind, Stan? Well,
we've just set the dates at the 29th and 30th of August.
Yeah, these are the confirmed dates. And our ICANN meetings team is already in the process of collecting quotes and so on for locations. So we'll get back to you on the location as soon as possible. But just so everyone knows, it looks like it's going to be Western Europe.
I think that's as soon as possible. The order for the record, as soon as possible has to be much sooner, because for some of us getting visas is a problem time-wise.
So I think Schengen visa would be the one you need.
Yeah, but we still need to know the specific location so that we can target
of course,
the
yeah.
specific.
We'll get back to you as soon as we can.
About 6:30 would be good.
6:30?
Eight sounds good.